Right now, it is time to bring in David Tarachuk. It is time for the Media Beat here on The Breakfast Club. David joins us every week at this time. We rebroadcast David on the weekend and also during the week, during our noontime hour. And also, you can find David at robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David has his own website. Of course, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Well, hello to you.
And I have to lead with the president's trip to England and to London especially. Boy, you want to talk about
ups? He went to Ireland as well, and also to France. But he I guess he spent most of the time in this flurried trip in my old home country. And, of course, he was not all that welcome, as he was the last time that he went. But that's not the way he saw it. It's interesting to see. I don't think he even read the reports. You can understand a leader being somewhat insulated from protests against him. And there were many protests against him. But, you know, the staff that prepare daily press briefings for the president don't have much work to do these days with Donald Trump, because he's not particularly interested. He knows what he wants to see in the media, and he sees it himself, mainly Fox News, as we know. So he didn't really know very much about the protesters. He said at one point, I don't see protesters, but only one small group of people. It must have caught his eye at some point. So overall, his summary, this is a very interesting quote, and I want to relish it, quoted absolutely accurately. Overall, he said the trip was, let me just get the very words. The very words were, it was love, great love. So that's how he saw his trip.
Well, it's the real important part of his trip, of course, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and D-Day is one of those days, David, that I say that we always seem to wait and celebrate the men and women of who gave their lives on that unbelievable day. Well, it was actually the start of the invasion. So many years ago, 75 years ago, to me, it is one of those dates that should be celebrated every year until every last one of those great soldiers that really changed the course of the world have passed. And then it should be incumbent upon us as a society, a world society, to remember that date every 5 or 10 years you want to. But it really was.
Sure, June 6th, 1944 was an extraordinary day for an action that, as you say, changed history. It certainly changed 20th century history, and we're still living with the legacy of that. And in some ways, putting that legacy at risk these days and remembering it a little more fully would, I think, I agree, be a rather good idea.
You know, we look at the Holocaust, and we all now are the ones that are burdened with the Holocaust to spread the word and to keep it going into future generations, that it never happened again. And I feel the same way about D-Day. When you look at the pictures, and every year I go through this, David, and the faces of the soldiers. They were kids. They were kids.
Sure, absolutely.
I mean,
and war so many times is fought by the young on behalf of the old. It's all too easily forgotten. The New York Times today is recollecting the youngest American who died in Vietnam. He was a young man from New York and a young African-American man, and he, by some freak, I think, because he just wanted to go to war and do his bit, he was only 15. So, you know, it's a most heartrending photograph of this young man in uniform. But yes, D-Day needs to be remembered, and it was remembered by the leaders of not only the victorious Allies, but the defeated country too, Germany, because that military action ended up, in the end, rescuing Germany from Nazi rule. and set it on a path to be the great power in Europe, power for good on the whole, many people would say, and I agree. So all these leaders were there, and of course the President of the United States is possibly the most powerful country in the alliance that beat Germany and its allies. And the President took the opportunity, standing in front of the graves of the men and women who died, to attack the prosecutor and vent some of his other resentments. It was a very peculiar mismatch. He went on, of course, to stick to his script and praise the dead, but it was a strange kind of anomaly to see these graves behind him as he went on one of his typical Trumpian tirades. It was a regrettable part of a very, very important occasion, I fear.
I want to give one quote from that stays with me every time I think of D-Day, and that is the quote from General Norman Daniel Dutch Cota, Sr. "We're being killed on the beaches. Let's march ahead, move ahead, and be killed inland." That tells you exactly what type of horror these thousands and thousands of international troops faced when they hit the beaches.
It could have been extraordinarily worse, too. You know that almost at the last minute, the day of D-Day was changed, put back 24 hours, and mainly because of one particular Scot. As a Scot, I'm rather proud of his efforts. So he was the main weather forecaster, and there was some argument between him and the main American weather forecaster, because, of course, General Eisenhower is the overall commander of the Allies in Europe, was absolutely dependent on accurate weather prediction for the operation to succeed. And Colonel Stagg, the Scottish forecaster, was concerned about build-up in the upper atmosphere, which suggested that it could be very bad weather, and that would make the crossing of the English Channel and the landing on the beaches all that much more dangerous and make them even more sitting ducks for the Germans when they caught on to the fact that the Allies were arriving. And in the end, the argument was won by the Scot, I'm glad to say, and everyone else was very glad to say, too, because it ended up being, I'm not going to say easy, but easier than it would have been otherwise. I mean, the casualty rate and the carnage would have been much, much worse if they'd gone ahead with their original plans. So an awful lot of very different things go into making a military victory. And of course, it wasn't a military victory right away. You were quite right. The next step was to, well, the almost immediate step was to move inland. And then, you know, finally in 1945, we were marching on, the Allies were marching on Berlin. Meeting up with the Russians, of course.
And I sit and I marvel. I'm not a big follower of the English throne, but I really do sit and marvel when I see the Queen, who now, of course, hosted President Trump. But you think back to who she originally hosted and what she has lived through and seen in her years is absolutely amazing as a powerful woman as she is.
I blank on the number now, but there's been almost a score, I think, of United States presidents that she has met in the course of her very long reign, celebrating the alliance and what the Brits and sometimes the Americans call the special relationship between the two countries. But of course, social media in Britain went crazy because Donald Trump at one point walked in front of the Queen, which is a complete no-no. Not that it would bother me too much to see that, but also the First Lady failed to curtsy to the Queen. Yeah, there are some times when I think my country is still just a little bit stuck in its old ways. Those kind of issues came to the fore. Whereas there was so much, formally at least, and this was the point of the Queen agreeing to the state visit, was that we weren't talking about fating a particular man, although he, of course, made a great effort to turn it into a family vacation for his entire crowd of offspring and their significant others. But the Queen and the British country's intention in all of this was to celebrate and honor the connection between the two countries, nothing to do with the individuals involved. But unfortunately, I think the nature of the individual involved made that very difficult in the end.
Why don't you bring up the interloper effect with the whole
drama? Yeah, he had a lot to say about British politics too, which is also a no-no when it comes to major diplomatic get-togethers. You don't criticize a country's internal politics when you arrive as a foreign dignitary, a visiting foreign dignitary. But criticize he did, and singling out particular individuals like the Lord Mayor of London too, and. Very interestingly, he had two people of South Asian descent to focus on. The mayor of London wasn't going to see him. He happens to be his family come from India. He's a Muslim. But then Trump also had to go to Ireland as well. Not a great pain for him because he has a home there of a kind. I mean, he has a golf course with rather sumptuous accommodations. So he went there. But the president, the prime minister of Ireland, the Taoiseach, as they call the office there, is an extraordinary individual because although it's Ireland, and you think of Ireland as a fairly socially cohesive and homogeneous kind of population, but of course Ireland is changing, and Ireland's leading politician now, the leader of the country, is of Indian descent. Leo Varadkar is his name, and he's gay, and he's all sorts of things that you wouldn't expect to be leading Ireland. So there Trump was introduced to, well, not introduced to, he's rather well aware of the London mayor. He's been having a spat with him for some time, mostly of his own making, although the London mayor gives as good as he gets, and rather more temperately and rather more coherently, I think. But there are these two examples of people who have come to, whose families have come to the West from South Asia, from the Indian subcontinent, and made extraordinary, interesting things of themselves, and performed a great role in leading populations in the West. It ought to be a lesson to him, and I'm not sure that it is.
You know, in the week that was, and I looking at the coverage of it, one thing that really wasn't highlighted was the absence of Vladimir Putin, who happened to be in China. For all these events.
talk about special relationships.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, again and again and again this happens because of, an anti-communist. The response of the West to the growth of the Soviet Empire immediately after the Second World War, that alliance that involved what was then the Soviet Union, in a way, and the Soviet Union performing a responsibility in that alliance, and in fact, in many ways, being enormously more greatly, the best way to put it, I suppose, is their sacrifice in terms of lost members of their armed forces. And the general population too. This was so much greater than the sacrifices, just speaking numerically, and I think in many ways the damage to the national psyche was so much greater. The losses that the Soviet Union suffered in conducting their share of beating Nazism was extraordinary. And yet after the war, the Cold War began, and Russia the Soviet Union, was exorcised from these sort of these Western allies' celebrations of their success, and no sign of the Russians at the celebrations about about D-Day, and of course that's understandable in the sense that we're talking about the Western European front, not the Eastern European front. But it's much more significant that, of course, Russia's leader now chooses to consort in an allied way with China. And interestingly, is very prepared to play second fiddle, as it were, to China. China is the dominant economy in that pairing of relationships, which is, of course, in the current circumstances, each are encouraging the other to form a closer and closer and more perfect union.
And when you think about the Second World War, if Hitler had not decided to open up a two-front war, it would have probably turned out a lot longer and a lot different. But the Russians...
Almost certainly, I'm sure.
And we're also not talking about the Pacific in all of this.
That took longer.
That's
and,
true.
A whole different kind of warfare, of course, too. But I guess the weakening of the Axis powers, Germany and Japan, by Hitler's defeat, made the end of the Pacific War inevitable too. But nothing so much as dropping atomic bombs on Japan. That was the decisive feature there. Entirely different kind of war.
No, completely. I only mention it from the world stat because of the world. I think that in the, let's call it, dueling parties department, the fact that while these celebrations were going on, President Xi and the Tsar were making very nice to one another and having meetings is. Not to be, not to go unremarked. But
no, you're right. It should be remarked upon, and here we are remarking.
Thank heaven for us.
If only after the event, and in a very small, in our very small way.
But at least we are striking a blow for truth. Just now, I have a question to ask you, and I've got a question. Marshall always answers this question the same way, but I'm opening the floor to both of you because it's a source of unending irritation. Do you think that it is the responsibility of a journalist or of the press to connect any dots? Or do you think that just every day, sort of like a golden retriever, good morning, can I have dinner? Breakfast.
Here are some facts, and we don't necessarily connect them to any other facts. Is that what you think? Some reporters might say that. I'm of the school that adheres to principles of Dragnet, the old television police procedural series. I'm the Sergeant Friday who says, just the facts, man, just the facts. But I add to that what our very important job is, like a good Sergeant Friday, is to connect those facts and provide some fuller context. That's what I believe the journalist's job is. You obviously have something in mind in bringing the subject up. Is there some lack of dot connection going on that's been bothering you?
I think what bothers Joe is what bothers everybody is that when you we're all old enough to know that we lived through a bevy of really significant journalists who took the time to connect the dots and to write stories, and it didn't matter how long it took to put the story together, to reveal the story with everything lined up and in place. Time was not of the essence. You did not rush to get the story put together. You put it together like it should be put together. Nowadays,
well, you rushed in the sense that if there was any competition involved, you worked damn hard to get it out before your competition.
But there was no social
media. And I'm afraid what we have now, of course, is a fantastically exaggerated version of that, in which the competition is so fierce now and so multiple. So many different sources, so many different outlets are rushing to publish all the time. And it's very hard to maintain one of those long-term investigations without wanting to rush to publication.
Yeah, well, that's the difference between news in the social media age and news back then is that, yes, there were stories that newspapers and that news organizations were trying to, of course, beat the other person out to get, but there wasn't the immediate need to publish as you have now.
Well, more to the point, you're absolutely right. It's not even more to the point. The social media as a news outlet is completely contaminated. And people are either going to understand that or not. So if you are forward thinking, you're going to start creating other means to get information out there simply because as people are deadened to this, but as... You know, as another, is all the information, when I say information, is all personal information is out there. It's just, you know, it's hopeless. The quote, Russian interference in the 2016 election was went further than hitherto. I love it when they say thought. It's like, no, guys, you've actually known for years how... precise and targeted an operation that was. Thanks for telling us now, 2 years later. Yeah, we really appreciate that. But the fact is that in terms of social media as news source, it's like you lost the room. It's over.
Well, that's in principle true. The truth is, and this is unfortunate or not, depending on your viewpoint, but the very fact that social media exists, the fact that it has become to be such a multiplicity of platforms, but they're all platforms that essentially are driven by the users and not the actual suppliers of information. They pick stuff up and then amplify it. Have actually become, as I say, like it or not, a major news source in themselves now, not least, of course, because the leading politician of the entire world, the person with the most power, is choosing to use Twitter as a funnel for policy announcements and lots of other things too. But the regular press, if you like, the legacy press, to use the almost dismissive adjective that's used often, has to pay attention to social media. Now, what they need to do with it, of course, it's a game most of the time of correction, not merely contextualizing and joining dots, but actually weighing what's rushing around the Twitter sphere and other social media platforms and correcting it, getting, you know, putting into the spread of it's like having a big rumor machine operating all the time, mm-hmm. and our job as journalists is to sift and evaluate the rumors like we do all the time when we go into a bar and you hear a story. I mean, right down to the basic sort of shoe leather kind of reporting that some of us still do. You hear something in a certain setting and it sounds interesting, and your next responsibility is to check it out. And if it checks out and it is of importance, then you try and publish. That's essentially what we all have to do with social media too.
And with information. And again, you know, obviously people are now being trained to do that, but from a purveyor standpoint, it is going to be increasingly necessary to connect the dots, and you'll stand apart from connecting the dots. And you know, this is not to say that social media is a news sort, blah blah blah, and you know, active, fast, compelling, addictive is going to go away, but I think that in 3 years, if we're still talking about this, we will be talking about, oh yes, you know, it's shifted now to back to closer to a shoe leather model, because people are absolutely. Can you imagine? Let's go back to D-Day for a second. Can you imagine D-Day on Twitter? I mean,
I'm afraid I can all too easily. Yes.
Yeah, just how mind-numbing and how you just have it. I mean, Keystone Cops on steroids. Not that everybody knows what the Keystone Cops. It's just the danger to coherence is
and understanding
is so clear at this juncture. That anyone who defends it, I'm not talking about using it to support your ends, whether they are nefarious or, all or angelic. I'm talking about anyone who thinks that this is the way to get your information is going to have to, will eventually come in for reprogramming.
Well, it's a very passive thing. I mean, we have vast audiences there now who are prepared to take news from Facebook or from a Twitter stream. And if they're content with that,
good luck.
So much the worse. And so much for worse for them. But I think the rest of us owe it to the world at large. To keep on insisting on the difference between information drawn from social media and information that has genuinely been checked out. And of course, there is a responsibility on the purveyors, as you call them themselves. And Facebook has at long last been pressured into doing some form of fact-checking itself and curtailing the wilder shores of extremism and untruth on its platform, but not very effectively because it is so vast and it's not putting the resources into it that such an exercise would really need. And we're ending up with some action taken, but not enough to actually turn Facebook into anything like a reliable source of information. So people, the best response you can have is just not to believe everything you read in Facebook. Like we used to say, don't believe everything you read in the papers. We all have to make our own value judgment in the end. And no matter how much curating and how much double checking we do, we're always left with the problem that in the end it's the consumer's responsibility ultimately at the end of the day.
I have to say this. I'm really sorry. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, the Media Beat.
Thank you.